Now we explore a new podcast series called Be Seen. It starts out this way with a question posed by Radio Milwaukee's Nate Imig.
When you think of Wisconsin's LGBTQ history, what important milestones, events, or people come to mind? Well, if you're struggling to come up with even one name or person or event that defined Wisconsin's LGBTQ history, well, you're probably not alone.
Join in on the people and events that come to mind, 800-642-1234. Michael Takosh is here, curator for the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project, collaborated with Radio Milwaukee on this six-part podcast series. Michael, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, good morning, everyone.
Good morning. So why do you think, you know, collaborating with Radio Milwaukee and Nate Imig on this and creating this podcast series, why is it important to get these stories out there, to get them told?
Oh, it's more important now than ever before. When I first joined this project in 2008, we still had access to an entire generation of people who were alive before Stonewall. And over the past 14 years, so many of those people have left us and taken their stories, their experiences, their perspectives with them. And I think that's a real loss for all of our Wisconsin culture. And when we lose those people, we lose so much. And unfortunately, we just continue to lose them. And the world has changed so much in their lifetime, and they have such a wealth of knowledge and experience to offer. But so often in the LGBT community, an ageist barrier exists between the young and the old, and that knowledge transfer just does not happen. There is not a generational passing down of cultural heritage or knowledge. There's not a lot of connection between old and young. And no real opportunity to learn.
You have also said that the dread of a historian is that there are things you know but others do not. And as you mentioned, you know, this is history that hasn't been passed down from one person to the next necessarily, one generation to the next. History of the LGBTQ community not necessarily taught in schools. How do you go about preserving it?
So the first thing is validating it. So we obviously work with a lot of, half memories. It's an interesting phenomenon when dealing with hidden history, is that you'll uncover something that is thought to be remembered, but may have just been culturally kind of, evolved over time from what actually happened to what people remember happening. And as we slowly forget what really happened, we fill in the blanks with maybe half-truths or folklore. So one of the first things that we do as a project is really seek to validate. So looking at what historical records, if any, exist in media, in police records, in photographs, in firsthand oral histories of people who were literally there as something happened. And again, this becomes increasingly difficult over time.
You have this incredible archive that's been built up at the LGBTQ History Project. Are you really sourcing this deep archive for the podcast?
So the Wisconsin LGBT History Project started way back after the 20th anniversary of Stonewall in 1994. There was a real concerted effort nationwide to begin documenting a history that was disappearing every day. I think that, as the community looked around, they realized they had a lot to celebrate after 25 years, but they had also lost a lot of the cultural heritage due to the AIDS epidemic, due to just the passage of time and the onset of generational shift. The Wisconsin Project began as a table exhibit at Pride Fest. And if you really think about it, we've evolved from this very small kind of, class project look and feel to the state's largest repository of LGBT historical multimedia. The project was founded by Don Schwamm, who is still involved as a founder, webmaster, and co-curator. But I joined the project in 2008 as more of kind of the front face, doing more of the media interviews, more of the public presentations, more of the publications, and a lot of research, like a lot of research. Don was really dealing with a lot of primary sources, LGBT media that had been published, TV interviews that had been broadcast. And then he had also documented literally every LGBTQ organization, person, and place that existed all the way up until 2008. So the website is extremely comprehensive, but we do recognize that in 2022, people don't really gravitate towards history. History is probably no one's favorite subject in school, aside from mine. This is probably because of the way that history is taught and the way it's consumed. So we've really strived to make the History Project accessible in new ways, portable in new ways, and most importantly, emotionally connective. And so that really led to the podcast as one of those projects to really transform a static and valuable online resource into something that was really being delivered to people in a kind of an experiential way.
Michael Takosh, our guide to this new podcast series, dropping one episode per week through the 27th. He co-hosts it. It's called Be Seen. Join in on how you acknowledge and celebrate gay history, gay pride, what you want to know about the LGBT History Project and its archives. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Michael Takosh here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring Wisconsin's LGBTQ history through this new six-part podcast called Be Seen. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The podcast is in collaboration with Radio Milwaukee, shared through its Uniquely Milwaukee podcast. Join in on the Stonewall era in Wisconsin, the evolution of gay bars, drag shows, how you view the movement today. 800-642-1234. We have historian and podcast co-host Michael Takosh with us for the hour. Michael, there is an episode that you really hone in on, Black Knight Bar in Milwaukee. Can you explain the importance of this bar, what it was like in the 50s and 60s?
Oh, absolutely. So the Black Knight was a bar that had actually been founded as a gay bar, which was unusual in 1960s Milwaukee. Many bars had existed that tolerated gay people, maybe allowed them to be served, maybe allowed them to be, you know, gathering in groups. But this was technically illegal in Wisconsin and many states at the time. And there were actually laws against serving alcohol to homosexuals because they were thought to be criminal and they were thought to be an immoral element that could cost businesses their licenses and really could cost the business owner their reputation from ever owning another license or business. So when the Black Knight opened, and it was very much designed as a for-profit gay bar by a very thoughtful financier who saw this as a get-rich-quick scheme, and hired what he called a useful idiot to run it. He unknowingly created one of the safest spaces and one of the most welcoming places for gay, lesbian, and gender nonconforming people in 1960s Milwaukee. And it was part of a strip of bars that has been long forgotten in Wisconsin because it was torn down in the 1960s systematically, first by a raging fire, second by the extension of St. Paul Avenue across the river, and third by the formation of 794, which goes from the Marquette Interchange to the lakefront. And this really buried this neighborhood. So for 60 years, there's been nothing on this land, even though the businesses, the buildings, the properties could have probably remained. They were out of the footprint of all of these targets. But they were still systematically torn down. We believe this is because of an incident that occurred on August 5th, 1961, where the LGBT community, for the first time in Wisconsin, at a time that was so much earlier than anywhere else in the country, except for tiny pockets in Philadelphia and shortly thereafter in San Francisco and Los Angeles, really stood up to homophobia and stood up to harassment and violence and really fought back in a way that was unprecedented, particularly in the Midwest, where, you know, that there really wasn't a lot of community or legal unity for gay and lesbian people or gender nonconforming people, particularly who are subjected to clothing checks by many police officers with an unwritten law that they had to wear three pieces of gendered clothing. So if they were suspected to be cross-dressing, as it was called, they could literally be stopped on the sidewalk and inspected, as it was called, which was really a very heavy form of police harassment. But back to August 5th, the outbreak that took place that night really was shocking. Four sailors came into a bar, refused to sign the book, as it was called, which was a way of making sure that they knew who had been in the bar and kind of a deterrent for people who might come there to cause harm. They chose instead to fight the bouncer who tried to eject them, and a young Black woman of trans experience stood up to them and like went outside and fought them and defended her boyfriend and her bar and knocked one of them out cold and sent him to the emergency room. The three remaining sailors vowed to come back later in the night to fight the woman and the bouncer and really clean up this queer bar, as they put it. So it was very clear that they were coming back there to do harm to gay people. It was not just a normal bar fight on a normal Milwaukee night out. And when they did return, what they did not at all plan for and completely underestimated was that this was a community pushed to the brink by so many different factors, from a lifetime of harassment and persecution and from feelings of shame from childhood all the way into adulthood that just eventually ignited into a rage.
Boiled over.
And when the sailors returned, the fight really erupted and the bar was completely totaled. And this went down in history in newspapers for the entire week afterwards as the Black Knight Brawl. And it was, again, legendary in so many ways. It changed the perception of gay people in Milwaukee from being docile, passive, and pushover to kind of scary and dangerous, like a sizzling undercurrent that was not known to be in Milwaukee.
I just want to pause there with you, Michael Takash, curator for the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project, as we talk about the podcast Be Seen. You can join in 800-642-1234. If you've heard the podcast, you want to talk about the history, now's the time. Call in 800-642-1234. You mentioned Josie Carter and the gender nonconforming queen who really defended the bar. And you have an actual interview of Josie Carter from 2011 when Josie was 73 years old. How important is that interview? What did she say?
So the Wisconsin Transgender Oral History Project, which was a separate project ignited in 2011 to preserve the voices of trans experience in Milwaukee and Wisconsin, had met with Josie and Jamie Gaze, who was Josie's sidekick throughout the late 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, like literally a lifetime. These two were really the it kids. They were really the club kids of their time. People would pay them to show up at parties, bar openings. They were really that famous. If they were there, it was known to be a good time and people would come. But this interview with them is really remarkable because it was filmed in Josie's home, where she was hosting kind of a cocktail lounge environment. And it was all, again, very firsthand. It was very primary source. And it was really life in their language. And I think that was one of the most interesting things for me when I first heard it. And then, you know, I had known Josie and I had met her several times and I had actually interviewed her a few times with some colleagues in Milwaukee before her passing in 2014. But this interview really stood out because she, for the first time, really talked about the Black Knight, and she really kind of mentioned details of the Black Knight. in a way that she hadn't done before. By 2011, 50 years later, the Black Knight had kind of become this urban legend. It was something that people would ask Josie to tell at parties, kind of like a parlor game. It was like a story that asked her to recount at parties, and then she'd share it, and they'd be like, oh, sure, this didn't happen. You know, this is just Josie telling some crazy story. But it really did happen. And I mean, there's documentation, police reports, media headlines, firsthand accounts. And I think this is the greatest demonstration of why preserving and documenting this history matters so much, is that the first LGBT uprising, the first mobilization of this community in Wisconsin history, was almost forgotten by history. It was almost submerged over time as the survivors passed away, the building was destroyed, the entire neighborhood was destroyed, everyone involved was scattered to the winds, and there was really nowhere to go to really understand like what this place was and why it was so important to everyone and why they were willing to fight for it.
Let's pause right there as we talk about this new podcast series called Be Seen, co-hosted by Michael Takash, curator of the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project. Join in on how you've witnessed equality, human rights in Wisconsin change over the decades, what people and events, past and present, you want to draw attention to. 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're learning there are layers upon layers of backstories to Wisconsin's LGBTQ history, and they come alive past meets present in this new short-run podcast series called Be Seen. We're discussing the podcast on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What historical milestones, events, businesses created a more inclusive community in Wisconsin? How do you connect current barriers to pre-Stonewall generations? Join in with your stories, your observations of the LGBTQ community in Wisconsin, 800-642-1234. We have historian Michael Takash, collaborated with Radio Milwaukee on the podcast series and is with us for the hour. Michael, the second episode explores what it was like, to have this really bustling bar for patrons, the now closed M&M Club in Milwaukee. And here's one guest who says the club was really important to them.
Coming to the M&M was your own private club. It was your own place to be, and you felt safe here. In those days, you know, it wasn't, the laws didn't protect our group, our tribe, as they do now.
How did the M&M create community and safety?
Well, the M&M was really, it was kind of a gay Cheers long before there was a Cheers TV show, because the owner really made sure that he knew everyone's name, he knew what they liked to drink, and he treated them to a wonderful experience. It was one of the rare places in Milwaukee where people could get a drink, have dinner, and see live entertainment all under one roof in kind of an old-fashioned hospitality style that hadn't been seen in a long time in Milwaukee. In a neighborhood that was rapidly changing, but when it opened in 1976, was fairly abandoned. In fact, within weeks of the M&M Club opening in July 1976, the Milwaukee Common Council was ready to sacrifice the Third Ward for a combat zone proposal that would have relocated all adult businesses in the city to one area, as was done in Boston and other cities around the world. Fortunately, that did not pass, but also fortunately, the M&M Club succeeded and started a 30-year legacy as kind of that place where everyone knows your name.
I was surprised that this is not just a place that was serving bar food and drinks. It was really actively creating community, like, you know, performing arts sponsorships and cast parties and softball leagues, dart leagues, other leagues. It was really, sounds like it was really trying to create community and friendships.
Oh, absolutely. And over time, the bar grew from being just, you know, a tavern to then a tavern plus a restaurant and then a tavern plus a restaurant and a courtyard. And then finally, in the final remodeling, adding a room on the second floor, which was then used for community gatherings. So if your nonprofit organization or your community group or sports team was hosting an event, Bob Schmidt would make sure you had a space and would make sure you had catering and would make sure you'd have bartenders. And it would all be done at a very affordable and welcoming price so that people could have that experience and really pull together community milestones.
What became of the M&M?
So Bob eventually retired, as one does after 30 years of running a business, and moved to California. The business was sold, and it has changed hands a few times since then, although the interior does still look very much like it did 16 years ago when the M&M Club closed. The curious thing is that unlike most bars in Milwaukee, which is certainly a tavern town and has been for, 150 plus years, is that the M&M Club hosts regular reunions and just hosted one this Mother's Day on May 8th. After 16 years of being closed, it brought easily 300 people into the bar and the adjoining lot for a very emotional reunion. I don't think I've ever seen so many tears in a bar in my life.
Mm. What was it like attending that reunion for you?
Well, for me, it was fascinating. We obtained a lot of firsthand interviews. We were able to talk to people about their emotional connection to the bar, what role it played in their life, what changes they've seen since the bar is closed. Really, the question for me was, what did Milwaukee lose when it lost the M&M Club? Because certainly there are still 7 LGBT first bars left in Milwaukee, but nothing really like the M&M Club. There's never been anything like it before and probably never will be again.
Let's talk a little bit about the drafting of legislation and the laws. And you really took a deep dive into the law as Wisconsin 40 years ago became, the first state in the nation to provide basic discrimination protections. What changed?
Well, in 1982, the campaign that really had started almost 15 years prior, going way back to a proposal from the Young Democrats of Wisconsin to eliminate sodomy laws, actually succeeded in 1982. And this was really groundbreaking nationwide. It was the first time that a state had offered and actually guaranteed protection from discrimination in housing, credit, public accommodation, and employment for gay men and lesbian women. So essentially, from that point forward, any discrimination that could be proven was technically illegal. The curious part was that although discrimination had been outlawed, gay men and lesbian women were technically still not defined as legal or
went backwards.
It was mm-hmm. very backwards. So the Consenting Adult Act, which became law in 1983, actually made the protected class that the discrimination was forbidden against. So it was a little bit backwards, but the two-part law really was groundbreaking and really changed life in Wisconsin for a generation that had grown up really, honestly, being illegal to exist.
Did you hear that change in your interviews for people who went through that time, 82, 83?
We did. So we spoke to people who, were out and active before, during, and after that. And the real change was the absence of police harassment. I mean, we do not live in a time now where police will come into bars, gather everyone up, put them in paddy wagons, and drive them around the city just to deter them from going to gay bars. We don't live in an era where police will sit outside gay bars in their police cars with their lights on, yelling obscenities at people going into gay bars to deter them from going to gay bars. The police harassment before the gay rights bill was severe. Mm. And it's kind of sad because going back to the Black Knight, the police sided with the patrons of the Black Knight and prosecuted the sailors who came there to do them harm. But, within the next 10 to 20 years, it had kind of shifted, and there were really some really unfortunate incidents that occurred in Milwaukee between police and the gay community that the gay rights bill really overturned and made go away forever.
We're talking about the history of legal protections for LGBTQ Wisconsinites with Michael Takash, curator for the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project, co-host of the new podcast, Be Seen. You can join in with your reflections, how you have seen protections change over time, and what life is like today, 800-642-1234. Michael, Wisconsin, as the first state in the country to have protections for gay residents codified into law, how did that influence neighboring states, if at all?
So Minnesota was actually on the forefront, and as well as Massachusetts, but they really didn't pull it together quite as soon or quite as effectively as Wisconsin did. And Wisconsin's approach was really brilliant. So you have to hand it to the people who were there and the people like Representative Clarenbach, who really were part of this, Leon Rouse, who was part of it, Dick Wagner, who was part of it. This collective of statesmen, this generation of negotiators, went through an era of political discourse that will never be seen again. The fact that they achieved this was so gentlemanly and so professional. And politics has changed so much since that time that I don't think this, if this were happening today, it would never happen, just simply because of the heat of the current political environment. But their approach was brilliant. So they didn't take on the discrimination protections as, you know, rights for gays and lesbians. They took the approach of, is it fair for any human to be denied these protections? Mm-hmm. And they worked with the faith community. They worked with the business community. They worked with the opposing parties in state legislature and really convinced everyone that, you know, this was unfair and inhumane. And that was the argument. It wasn't, is gay good or is gay right or is gay moral? It was, is it immoral and wrong to deny any human these protections? And that was an argument that no one argued against, and that's how they won. And it really is astonishing when you look at the multi-tiered plans they put together, the way they went about rolling this out. I mean, it could have only happened at that moment in time, the short window after gay liberation and before the AIDS crisis, and before the shifts in national politics towards the moral majority and more conservative right. But Wisconsin really made a name for itself, and it's sometimes unfortunate to think about how far we've swung backwards from there.
I just want to dwell a moment on statesmen and give a nod to LGBTQ activist, author, historian Dick Wagner, who died in December at age 78. And, you know, I mean, we talked about his pre-Stonewall tome, his post-Stonewall Stonewall book. You met him after he published his first book on gay history. What was his influence on the history and on the archives?
Well, our project had actually started back in 1995. So really they were tandem efforts, but mm-hmm. they were in some cases very complementary. But in some cases they were separate. I mean, Dick was not part of the history project, but his work certainly benefits the history project. And I think vice versa.
Michael Takash with us, curator of the LGBTQ History Project, amassing and cataloging Wisconsin's LGBTQ history, which comes to life in a new podcast series we're talking about with Radio Milwaukee. It's called Be Seen. It's still time to talk about the history that you haven't heard about or want further digging reflections on Wisconsin's gay-friendly spaces, a bar that may have faded away. Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Michael Takash here on the Ideas Network. It is a behind-the-scenes look at the podcast series Be Seen, dropping every Monday this month in collaboration with Radio Milwaukee. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The podcast digs deep into the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project archives, connects with present-day interviews to help build a clearer picture of how our state's community formed these tight-knit institutions. Share in the history how you see it, 800-642-1234. We have historian Michael Takash, co-host of Be Seen, with us for 9 more minutes. Michael, Kathy from Dodgeville listening emailed in and wants to highlight the Wisconsin Historical Society book, We've Been Here All Along, as we talked about Dick Wagner's book on early gay history. And Kathy said a moment that stands out to her in that book is the history of Robert Neal and Edgar Hellam, this gay couple in the 30s who the Chicago Tribune says created Mineral Point's tourist and historical preservation industry, and the Wisconsin Historical Society called them the couple that saved Cornish history. It sounds like right there is just such a wealth of history to dig into.
Yes, and actually this one hits close to home for me as someone of Cornish heritage, not from Mineral Point, but from the UP. And I think it's a great demonstration of the fact that, you know, Dick's title could not have been more accurate. And that is constantly what we're finding as we're going back in our research. We've just completed our next book, which comes out on June 27th, which covers the history of drag in Milwaukee. And you wouldn't expect to find drag superstars living in Milwaukee in the 1920s, 1910s, 1880s, but they were. And so much like the gentleman who rescued Cornish culture in Wisconsin and really built a legacy in Mineral Point that's still there today to be witnessed and to behold, LGBT people have been part of Wisconsin history and all of the communities statewide all along. Mm-hmm. And whether or not they've been loud about it, whether or not they've been visible, they've been there and they can't be denied. And I think that that's the important message. One of our since last summer's illumination of the Hone Bridge in honor of Josie Carter, the 60th anniversary of the Black Knight, our mantra has really been be seen. And I think that, you know, this is what needs to happen in order for things to change and for people to recognize that LGBT people have been part of the historical context all along, is that they just need to be seen more. They need to be visible. They need to be vocal. They need to be loud. And especially right now, given the national political climate.
You mentioned the drag shows reaching back to the 1800s. And I just want to play a moment of the podcast. You and co-host Nate Imig, you take us back to the state's first drag show on June 7th, 1884.
At a time when Milwaukee did not have paved streets, sewer systems, indoor plumbing, or even electric lighting yet. In fact, City Hall had not yet been built. The Pabst Theater was still 10 years away. And most of the population lived within 1 mile of Wisconsin and water.
Okay, so quite a bit of scene setting there. What might have Milwaukee's first drag show have looked like?
So Milwaukee's first drag show featured Francis Leone, who was known nationally first as the famous Leone, and then as he becomes so famous that he inspired impersonators of his female impersonator act. He became known as the only Leone. Really quite a fascinating character, traveled the world, opened multiple theaters, toured Australia as a female impersonator in the 1870s. I mean, just a really unique character, but definitely a very queer character and, faced a lot of discrimination and even hostility in public because he was not just that character on stage. He was that character every day. And he lived a life of what we might today call maybe transgender, but definitely gender fluid. And because of that, he faced a lot of scrutiny. But the first show that he brought to Milwaukee came at a time when, you know, public theater was so new and so coveted. I mean, Milwaukee was changing so fast in the 1880s and growing and developing and Germanizing in ways that were unexpected. You still had original settlers' cottages along the river right behind the theater in which the famous Leone appeared on June 7th. His show really wowed the city. The Milwaukee Sentinel gave it a glowing review. And I think the one takeaway quote that I always point to is that the famous Leon could make a fool of a man if he didn't realize that he was a man, and most people don't believe that he really is. It just speaks to the glamour of female impersonation and the fact that people want to be entertained and paid to be fooled. I mean, they wanted to believe it was a woman. They wanted to prove that it was a woman in many cases. And there was really a separation between the offstage queer identity and the onstage entertainment personality that made it safe to be there and in the space that might otherwise be seen like today as a gay space.
Yes. Make that giant leap to today from that, that history. What does your knowledge of that history tell you about this renewed push of drag queens today and also the barriers?
Sure. So, I mean, I think that the fascinating thing about Milwaukee is that drag has been there all along. So whereas in other cities, drag was outlawed, it was banned, it was seen as kind of a deviant behavior. There was an association between drag queens and men who wanted to be women. There was an entire nationwide controversy in the late 1930s called, unaffectionately, the Moron Menace, which claimed that homosexual men were dressing up as women to rape women. None of it made any sense. It was just sensationalist lore. But it was really driven to put an end to the 1930s pansy craze, which was like a really flowery period in which America really became much, much more gay, and people began to consider sexual identity for the first time in America because until the 1930s, they didn't realize there was any alternative to just growing up and being like your parents. And that, you know, these feelings that they might be having meant something and that they might lead to a divergent path from previous generations. But because drag has been so constant in Milwaukee and was never outlawed and has just constantly been there, it's really led to Milwaukee being this launch pad for, you know, the drag superstars of now. I mean, we've already sent four people to RuPaul's Drag Race, potentially even more in the future, as I'm told. And it's just been really interesting to see how infused drag is with local culture and the fact that, you know, you have, you know, drag queen story time at the library, you have drag queen brunches that are no longer limited to gay bars. You have drag queens at the Brewer game. You have drag queens at the Bucks games. It's the drag presence is dominant. And I can't really say that any other Midwestern city can claim that heritage.
Only about 10 seconds left, unfortunately. What is the reaction to the podcast? What are you hearing?
Actually, wonderful, wonderful news. We've seen a massive spike. We've released the fourth episode, which focuses on the Vanishing Women's Bar, which is a really important thing to talk about. And within 24 hours, we've had over 1,000 listens, which is amazing.
Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Takash, curator for the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project, collaborated with Radio Milwaukee on this 6-part podcast series, Be Seen. We have a link to it at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.